Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's joint meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and the Stanford San Francisco Club, brought to you from the Commonwealth Club offices overlooking San Francisco's Market Street. I'm Lee Ziegler, president of the Stanford Club. We also welcome those joining us today on radio and invite all of you to visit the Commonwealth Club's website at commonwealthclub.org. And now for today's speaker. James Risser has had distinguished tenure as professor of communication at Stanford from 1985 until his retirement earlier this year. He was director of the John S. Knight Fellowships, a mid-career sabbatical program for outstanding professional journalists from the U.S. and abroad, which over the years has brought to our club many outstanding speakers. But Jim's career has reached well beyond the academic. He received his undergraduate degree from the University of Nebraska and earned a law degree at the University of San Francisco. He practiced law for 2 years before moving to journalism. He was Washington Bureau Chief of the Des Moines Register and won Pulitzer Prizes for national reporting in 1976 and 1979. The first was for uncovering corruption and bribery in the U.S. grain exporting industry, stories that led to criminal convictions and to congressional passage of legislation regulating grain inspection and shipping. The second Pulitzer was for a series exploring the destructive impacts of modern American agriculture on the environment. Jim currently serves on the Journalism Advisory Committee of the Knight Foundation, and he is a trustee of the American Conservatory Theater here in San Francisco. He is a member of the steering committee of the Committee of Concerned Journalists. Jim also does freelance writing as part of the American Journalism Review's recent project on the state of the American newspaper. He wrote an in-depth article on the disappearance of independent and family-owned newspapers in the U.S., which brings us to today's program, The American Newspaper in Turmoil and Transition. It gives me great pleasure to present to you James Risser.
Thank you, Lee. Good afternoon. I was going to begin this talk by wishing you a happy day after the election. And I was going to say that you were undoubtedly relieved about one thing, that you wouldn't have to read or watch anymore about the election. How wrong I was. I'm here to talk about newspapers, and I will do that, but because of events and because I'm an observer of broadcast news as well, and because I covered 4 presidential elections as a journalist, I want to say just a couple words first about last night before we turn to newspapers. This was not television's finest hour, to put it mildly. In fact, the performance last night by the networks, I think, called into question the whole system by which the networks project and declare election winners based on exit polls and vote counts in sample precincts. That system has been criticized before, but usually because of its alleged impact on voting patterns, such as where an early declaration of a winner based on returns from the East reduces voting turnout in Western states where the polls are still open, that kind of criticism. This time, though, the system itself was simply wrong. I assume most of you were watching the returns last night, or some of them. And if you didn't go to bed too soon, you know what happened. The networks led by CNN at first declared that Vice President Gore had won Florida and started talking about the prospects of a Gore victory nationally. Then later the networks retracted their call and said the state was still up for grabs. And then, as you probably know, as the evening progressed, the networks declared that Governor Bush had won Florida and with it the presidency. At that point, Gore, like the rest of us, considered the race over and called Bush to concede. Various newspapers, including the San Francisco Chronicle, went to press with headlines declaring Bush the winner. sort of shades of 1948 and Dewey beats Truman. Then as Gore prepared to deliver a concession speech and Bush got ready to give a victory speech, actual officials from Florida reached the Gore people and said, wait a minute, it's close, there are absentee ballots, and besides, it looks like the result will be close enough that under Florida law, there will have to be an automatic recount of all the ballots. So then Gore calls Bush, retracts his concession, and that's where we are now with a Florida recount underway, which is supposed to be completed by late tomorrow. However, it apparently is not going to include the overseas absentee ballots, which may be another who knows how long. You know, I think this may be a little too apocalyptic or something, but I think it's fortunate that we have a relatively stable democracy in this country and a process for dealing with this kind of thing. In some countries, this kind of fiasco with various declarations and retractions about who is the new leader of the government could have touched off rioting or even a revolution, I suppose, in some countries where things are more volatile. But what this event should and I think will do is touch off a reexamination of the way television goes about reporting election returns using exit polls and sample precincts, but not very often real votes or not real votes in great quantity. When it's television and not actual election returns that declares winners, there's the potential for something to go drastically wrong, as it usually does not, but as it did last night. So I'm not sure what the solution is, but perhaps we need a pledge from all the networks that in 2004 they will show election returns over the air as they come in. They'll discuss who's ahead, who might win, who might lose, and so forth, but refrain from really declaring winners until the real results are known and there's no chance of the kind of mistake that happened last night. Well, the topic I was assigned to talk about today, however, was some of the changes and questions facing American newspapers, and which is a background that I come out of, as Lee said, having worked for 20 years for a newspaper before going into academia. And there are many questions about the changes and questions facing newspapers, more such questions perhaps than at any time in our history. I want to leave time for your questions and comments. I found that when the topic is the press, there usually are lots of questions, sometimes even thrown objects, but I trust there won't be any of those, at least. But let me begin by asking you if this story sounds familiar. There is a city in the United States where there are two daily newspapers. One is owned by members of a family. The other is owned by a large corporation. One paper has a very large circulation, with many subscribers spread over a fairly large geographic area. The other has a comparatively small number of readers and a smaller geographic reach. The larger paper gets larger, the smaller paper gets smaller. Perhaps the two papers combine their business operations under a joint operating agreement where they print separate papers with separate staffs but save on business advertising, circulation, and so on. Then as the family-owned paper descends to a larger number of second and third and fourth generation heirs, there's less interest in journalism per se than maybe the original founding father of the paper had. There's more interest in making money. And so the family members eventually decide to sell the paper. The corporation that owns the other paper buys the family paper and makes the decision to continue publishing the larger of the two papers. They might shut down the smaller paper entirely, or maybe because of the joint operating agreement, they might decide that legally they have to make an effort to keep the smaller paper alive and sell it to another owner. So the city ends up with just one daily newspaper, or maybe one very dominant one and a smaller one whose future is uncertain. What city is this? San Francisco? It could be, but it could be a number of other cities, with only a few variations in the facts here and there among the cities. It could be Lincoln, Nebraska, where I grew up and where the larger family-owned Lincoln Journal was bought out by the smaller Lincoln Star, owned by the publicly traded corporation Lee Enterprises. The result was a single daily newspaper in that state capital city. Or it could be Des Moines, Iowa, for whose newspapers I worked for 20 years. There, the morning Des Moines Register, large, statewide, and the evening Des Moines Tribune, smaller and more local, were both owned by the Coles family and published for many decades. But times changed, and to save money, the evening paper was shut down. Then a few years later, the family decided to cash in its investment and sell the Morning Register. The winning bidder was the Gannett Company, which is the largest owner of American newspapers, now owning about 100 newspapers, ranging in size from very small to the very biggest, USA Today. Or the city in question might be Philadelphia, or Louisville, or Minneapolis, or Providence, or Phoenix, or Miami, or a large number of other cities around the nation. This, in fact, is what's been happening in one way or another all over the United States in the last few decades. The trend is toward more and more cities having just one daily newspaper and toward ownership by large publicly held corporations. Here are just a few numbers. In the early part of the 20th century, there were well over 2,000 daily newspapers in the United States. There now are just under 1,500, a drop of more than 25%. And in more recent times, say at the end of World War II, about 75% of daily newspapers were still independently owned. That is, owned by a family or a company that essentially published only that newspaper. But today that figure has reversed itself. Only about 300 of the remaining 1,500 daily newspapers are independent. In other words, only about 20% independent ownership. And most of those that do remain are quite small newspapers, half of them with circulations of under 10,000 daily. How about newspaper readership? The total circulation of daily newspapers in the U.S. reached a high of about 63 million in 1987, but it has dropped to close to 55 million today, while over the same time the adult population of the country has grown by about a fifth. The circulation of Sunday papers didn't start dropping quite that soon. It peaked in 1993 at 62.6 million, according to figures published in this past Monday's New York Times. But Sunday circulation also has dropped 4.2% since 1993. That is a big worry to newspaper owners because the huge amount of advertising that Sunday papers carry. A continued drop in Sunday newspaper circulation could mean reluctance on the part of advertisers to shell out their money. Those figures, dropping circulation and growing population, mean, of course, that per capita readership is falling. Newspapers get passed around the family, around the barbershop, around the coffee house, so it's hard to know exactly on how many people look at a newspaper on a given day. But some estimates are that a little over half of adults read a daily newspaper today, compared to about three-fourths of adults a generation ago. One thing that's very clear is that the readership of newspapers is becoming older and more elite. That is, younger people and people in lower income and or lower education groups do not read newspapers as much as older and more well-off people. And this is a trend that seems to be accelerating as the years go along. The New York Times story that I referred to about falling Sunday circulation noted that the median age of Sunday newspaper readers in the U.S. Now is 51 years of age. A good many of those are retired or other non-working people. Well, there's probably many reasons for this. Some studies indicate that younger people as a group have grown less and less interested over the years in government and public affairs and politics, which are topics that daily newspapers traditionally specialize in. The pathetically low voting turnout by younger people in most elections seems to be some evidence of that kind of disinterest. But younger people also are in some cases reading other things than daily newspapers, getting their news or some version of it from other sources, such as alternative newspapers, specialty magazines, radio, TV, and now, of course, the Internet. Back for a moment to patterns of newspaper ownership. Does it really matter whether a newspaper is independently owned or whether it's part of a corporate chain ownership? And does it really matter whether there's more than one daily newspaper in a city? My answer to those two questions would be yes, but. There are some advantages to the consumer, to the reading public, of having its newspaper being under an independent ownership. There are things that an independent newspaper can do, such as forego rising profit margins in a particular year when the economy is down, but the paper wants to continue doing good, vigorous journalism. Many independent papers do that, that is, take a lower profit margin in a particular year. And also, independent newspapers often have larger reporting and editing staffs than corporate-owned papers. A newspaper that's corporate-owned and accountable to stockholders doesn't have that same freedom and will try to cut costs somewhere to keep their profit margins up. And the biggest way for newspapers to cut costs is to trim the size of the staff or reduce the funding for things like investigative or in-depth projects that cost money, or even cutting the actual size of the newspaper page. Some newspapers are doing that these days, and you'll see a newspaper that's narrower in size. That can actually save a lot of money because after personnel costs, newsprint is the biggest budget outlay that a newspaper has. Either way, cutting staff and spending on reporting projects or cutting the physical size of the newspaper, the reader loses something. On the other hand, and that's the but part of my answer, not every independent newspaper is a gem. One of the papers I studied when I did the article for American Journalism Review that Lee referred to about independent newspapers was a Daily Oklahoman, which is the family-owned newspaper in Oklahoma City. In my article, I concluded that the Daily Oklahoman was what I called a journalistic underachiever because the owners were keeping the staff tiny, undertaking very little vigorous journalism and funneling the profits into their other non-newspaper enterprises. Some months later, the Columbia Journalism Review was even more blunt. They did an article in which they called the Daily Oklahoman the worst newspaper in the United States. Nevertheless, it's an article of faith among journalists, and there's much evidence to support it that independent ownership does have some benefits in terms of the news product. And that at their best, independent newspapers can do things that others can't. Gene Roberts, who all of us in journalism regard as one of our sort of saints of the journalism business, he's a revered former editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, which won dozens of Pulitzer Prizes during his years there. He has said that chain ownership has become so pervasive that giant corporations pipe the tune to which most of journalism marches, and so that editors and publishers nowadays have to focus less on journalistic pursuits and more on the financial bottom line. One of the things that sometimes happens, too, is that newspapers under group ownership often develop a corporate look and feel, and they develop a certain style and story length and newspaper page design. And if you're a newspaper junkie, as I am, and you wander around the United States and buy a newspaper in a particular city, you may have noticed that newspapers are beginning to look more and more like each other, being printed, laid out, designed, and are sort of a formula that somebody has decided is a good way to do it. Better, says Gene Roberts, to let newspapers be as individualistic as the communities they serve rather than being bland lookalikes. Newspapers owned by publicly held corporations are under constant pressure to maximize their profits and make the company appealing to investors. And make no mistake about it, newspapers make lots of money. Operating profits, which traditionally were somewhere between 10 and 15% at most newspapers, are ranging nowadays 25 and even 30% at the corporate-owned papers. Having to strive constantly for that kind of financial success produces a different mindset in editors and publishers than, say, the slogan of the old Chicago Times, which was, "It is the duty of a newspaper to print the news and raise hell." It's the duty of a newspaper to make money seems to be more the slogan at some papers these days. Some of you may know of Jay Harris, who's the very thoughtful editor of the San Jose Mercury News. He said in a recent issue of the American Editor, Today, newspaper companies must perform competitively as businesses in the marketplace, doing so at the same time that we fulfill our responsibilities as journalists and compete effectively with our many competitors is the great test and challenge facing the leaders of newspapers and newspaper companies. Harris knows what he's talking about because his paper is owned by Knight Ridder, which is a publicly traded corporation, although one with a pretty good reputation for publishing quality newspapers. But clearly, he feels these pressures and conflicts between trying to publish a fine newspaper, on the other hand, and trying to satisfy the expectations of investors. I asked the question, too, does it really matter whether a city has more than one daily newspaper? Again, it's a question that can't be answered with a strict yes or no, but the answer is more on the yes side. It's yes if the two newspapers, or three if we're lucky, are of decent journalistic quality, because competition usually makes newspapers better. Each one spurs the other one to do good work, to not miss a story, to not cover up or ignore a story. And that's usually the case, which is why I would say yes to competition. But there are, of course, instances of competing newspapers in cities and both newspapers not being that terrific. Occasionally, competing newspapers get involved in the sort of circulation war that leads them to become sensationalistic and irresponsible. That's not as rare these days as it was back in the so-called days of yellow journalism, but it does happen. So independent ownership and competing newspapers, I would say yes, for the most part. We would hope for that. I keep referring here to good newspapers and bad newspapers. What does that mean? I mean, what makes a newspaper good? You can make your own list of what attributes you think a good newspaper has, but my list would include the following. First, and probably foremost, a commitment to thorough news coverage that gives readers the information they need to be informed and engaged citizens. The whole justification for having the Press Freedom Clause in the First Amendment to the Constitution is that citizens need to be fully informed in order to make a democracy safe and functioning. And with that freedom goes a responsibility, I think, on the part of the press to do thorough news coverage, especially of public affairs issues. Other qualities of a good paper, I would say, are enterprise and courage in undertaking difficult and in-depth and investigative stories that help explain problems and promote change. A dedication to the well-being of the community that the paper's in, all segments of that community, by being part of the community, but in somewhat of a dispassionate way and helping to bring to light both successes and faults in the community. The spending of sufficient resources to hire and maintain a high-quality reporting and editing staff. The presentation of news and features in an attractive and literate way. An intelligent editorial page and opinion section that intelligently analyzes issues and takes coherent positions, but which also provides a forum for other points of view. And always a high sense of integrity and ethics, including independence from advertisers and other pressure groups. That's my list. You can come up with your own. I think it's fair to say that the future of journalism, not just newspapers, is in many ways up for grabs. A lot of this is due to the astounding technological developments of the past couple decades. When I worked first as a reporter, I worked on a manual typewriter of the kind that Herb Kane, I guess, never did give up. But eventually I went to an electric typewriter and then an early primitive computer with a paper roll in it, and then the first computers with the small screens, and then you know what we have today, the bigger ones with the large brains. The changes in journalism itself have been nearly as fast as that technological change of about one generation. With the biggest change in journalism, I would argue, being the rise of television and the ability to transmit pictures and words live all around the globe. It isn't just newspapers that have changed. Television arrived, and television has changed everything, and not always for the better. On the good side, it has shown us what wars are really like, and it puts voices and faces to names we used to only read about, and it can show the drama of big world events like the crumbling of the Berlin Wall and other such things. But it hasn't all been positive because TV also engages in excess, the O.J. Simpson case, any number of other things you might think of, and in general the rise in celebrity coverage. And television has radically affected our politics so that it sometimes seems we're choosing our elected officials more on the basis of looks and charisma and performance skills than on the policies they advocate and the way they carry out their duties. It's as important how they look and perform in the debates as what they say, whether they sigh or groan or smile. And it's important, it appears these days, that the presidential candidates appear on the David Letterman and Jay Leno shows, which are hardly the traditional forums of reasoned political analysis, but it's what is done these days. And, of course, TV drastically affects politics through campaign advertising. It may be that the Internet will bring an even bigger change in the world of information and to journalism. Many would argue that it already has, or is starting to, or will in the future. Both television and the Internet have made big impacts on newspapers, and newspapers are still struggling to cope with those impacts. Television obviously gets the news first and with pictures, and that has changed the way that many newspapers approach news coverage. They now, the better newspapers at least, try to do more big national, international, and even local stories for that matter in more depth and background, recognizing that people already probably know the bare facts from television. That's what many newspapers are trying to do these days. That's the direction they're trying to go. There have been some efforts by newspapers to try to compete with television on its own turf, which is essentially what USA Today did when it first came out. Little short stories, lots of color, sold from boxes that looked like television sets, and so on. But as USA Today has matured, it's gone back somewhat more in the direction of traditional newspapers, doing very good longer stories about big issues while still keeping some of the features that were part of its appeal. The Internet's also having a big impact on newspapers. Some think the Internet will eventually make newspapers, at least as we've known them, disappear. I don't know whether that will happen, but what is clear is that the Internet, of course, has developed news sites of its own, which, like TV, often come out beating newspapers on a story. Although on occasion their degree of accuracy has been a bit shaky, but they're often there first. And one of the impacts on newspapers is that newspapers have developed their own websites, not so much because they wanted to, really, but kind of to protect themselves, to get their feet into the Internet waters and see how that new medium goes. Some newspaper websites are just a way of posting stories that appear in that day's paper so that people can read them online. Others include a massive archive of past editions of the paper, and others have turned their website into a continual news operation so that you can see what's in that day's print version of the paper, but also get late-breaking news as it happens. There are, of course, even Internet sites reporting on the news industry itself. If you're a news industry junkie, as I am, you may be interested in a site that I enjoy called Jim Romanesco's Media News. Do some of you know that? That site. It's distributed by the Poynter Institute for Media Studies, and it's where I first found out that the new San Francisco Chronicle, as we will call the new one that comes into being in a couple of weeks, that it's selected its publisher. Although the Chronicle itself has not announced that nor acknowledged the story on this website, as far as I know, nor has the Chronicle acknowledged a report that it will begin publishing a kind of late day afternoon edition of the Morning Chronicle once it becomes the main paper in town. Anyway, if you're a news junkie and like sites like that, it's www.poynter.org/media news. So if you're interested, I recommend it. In any case, I don't expect the Internet to make newspapers disappear anytime soon, but no matter what happens with the Internet, with TV, it's also hard to see any strong prospects for newspapers to reverse their decline in circulation and to start growing, although I hope I'm wrong about that. I surely would like to see a reversal in the circulation decline of newspapers. There are, it has to be said, a lot of other places people get their news, specialty magazines, which are astounding any time you go into a store and look at the number of magazines on almost any topic you can conceive of. Those things, even though they may not be reporting general news, they compete for readers' time, so they're a form of competition for newspapers. And one rather maybe positive side of the newspaper picture these days is that there are quite a few successful suburban papers that have risen up and do fairly well and often compete on the margins, at least, with the big city daily. When we speak of San Francisco becoming a one newspaper town, or maybe two, depending on what the New Examiner turns out to be, in a way, we're not really. There actually are a very large number of daily newspapers that you can buy in San Francisco, even though they may not be published here. There's the papers that come down from Marin and across from the East Bay and up from the peninsula, and the San Jose Mercury News now is publishing a San Francisco edition, and of course you can even get home delivery here of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. So looking at it that way, in a way it's not a one newspaper town, and that's not even to mention the alternative newspapers such as the Bay Guardian and others that usually come out weekly and take a little more free-swinging approach to the news and opinion than do the so-called establishment press. The point of listing of these other kinds of media is to say that journalism is rapidly changing. Daily newspapers have all types of competition from other media, both print and non-print, and no one really knows how it's all going to sort out. You see that uncertainty from a business point of view when you see media companies scrambling to decide what they want to own. Some seem to have decided to be purely newspaper companies. Some want to have a mix of newspapers and broadcast. Some are embracing the internet more. Before I stop and take your questions, I wanted to mention another issue that newspapers are trying hard to cope with these days, which is not directly part of the business operation, and that is their lack of credibility with many readers. Many, many surveys have shown that newspapers are not trusted by readers. Sandra Rowe, who is the editor of The Oregonian and a recent president of the American Society of Newspaper Editors, put it like this. She said, quote, "We don't trust you," the readers shout. "You can't even get the little things right, so you must really blow it on the big things. You're arrogant. You don't respect the privacy of others. You're too negative. You're too liberal. And you don't write about things that are important to me," end of quote. To those complaints that Sandy Rowe listed, I'd add a couple of others that you often hear. One is that newspaper coverage is too crisis-driven. That is, that newspapers give a lot of attention to the crisis or supposed crisis of the moment, but don't do a good job of covering non-crisis news or giving people the background that would let them put a crisis in context. And two, that newspaper coverage is too celebrity and entertainment driven. This is a criticism that I mentioned is also made of TV, but it also gets made of newspapers. In any case, the public's disdain of newspapers on credibility grounds is a source of great pain to newspaper editors, the vast majority of whom really do want to do a good job of covering news and serving the public. But as a result of findings like survey findings about reader distrust, ASNE, the Newspaper Editors Organization, has launched a multi-year project they call the Newspaper Credibility Project to see what they can do, and that involves not only conversations with staff and journalism experts, but with readers and citizen focus groups. It must be said that in defense of newspapers, I think that some of this public mistrust is misplaced. Newspapers always have been controversial throughout our history. If they do their job well and they fulfill their mission as a watchdog for the public, they probably always will be controversial and often disliked. We often like to blame the messenger for news that we would rather not see or that upsets us. And so newspapers often are unpopular, probably always will be. As Michael Gartner, a Pulitzer Prize-winning newspaper editor, put it recently, rather crudely, I have to admit, "You show me a beloved newspaper editor, and I'll show you a shitty newspaper." That may be a bit over the top, but it does convey a certain truth that there are certain things that newspapers have to do to fulfill their role that may not always make them popular. And on the credibility question, I think it's well to keep these things in perspective and remember the words of Jane Kirtley, who's a distinguished journalist and lawyer who now teaches media ethics. She said, if you think the American press has a credibility problem, I invite you to go to any country in the world where the government controls the news media. And, of course, she's right about that. Almost the very first thing that happened when all the former communist countries threw off communism is one of the first things they wanted to do was establish independent, non-government controlled newspapers. And then the same in broadcast journalism, because they realized how important that was. On the optimistic side, if one is feeling down about the quality of newspapers, one way to boost your spirits is to get hold of the stories and columns and editorials that win the Pulitzer Prize each year. I had the great pleasure of serving until last year, served for a decade on the Pulitzer Prize board. And I can tell you from my experience there that the quality of the best journalism in the country is better than it's ever been in our history. It's better conceived, it's better researched, it's far better written than things you could find in even the best newspapers 50 years ago. Also, the Pulitzer process has changed in recent years to include awards in such new categories as investigative reporting and explanatory journalism, topics like that, as a way of encouraging and rewarding the kind of journalism that modern newspapers do the best. So the best newspaper journalism still has a tremendous beneficial impact on public policy. One example is the San Francisco Chronicle's outstanding work on the number of injuries and even deaths caused by the use of unsafe hypodermic needles and syringes when there was a much safer and not very expensive type of needle available. As a direct result of those stories, Congress approved and President Clinton, just day before yesterday, signed into law new rules requiring medical facilities to use these safer devices. So newspapers can and do have a beneficial impact. I think that I will stop at that point. I was just going to say that there are newspaper groups forming, like the Committee of Concerned Journalists, which Lee mentioned, on whose steering committee I served, who are trying to look at ways to get straying newspapers and straying journalism back to their core principles and to fulfill their mission in American society. I think that newspapers do remain and should remain a vital and positive force in our political and social system. But like television, when it makes mistakes in calling elections, newspapers have to acknowledge and look at their own mistakes and try to do a better job of fulfilling their crucial role in our society. Thank you.
Thank you, James Risser, Professor Emeritus of Journalism at Stanford University, for your remarks here today. It's now time for our question and answer period, and I should say that I have received a bushel basket of questions here, some of which have already been addressed by your talk, but I will give you a representative few. First one, do newspaper editorials still serve an important function, or are they an anachronism in the era of corporate newspaper ownership?
Well, the answer is yes. I mean, I think they do still serve an important function. I don't think they're an anachronism, really, although the impact that editorials actually have on readers is questionable, how much it influences opinions. There are surveys that show, for example, that when newspapers editorially endorse candidates for office, that it has very little impact on people's opinions as to how they're going to vote for president or for high national offices like Congress, but that it does have an impact on their decision-making and voting on local races. I also think, elections aside, that the newspaper editorials, if they're well studied and well done, can take a controversy or an issue and analyze it, come up with some kinds of prescriptions and make recommendations that I think sometimes do influence public opinion and can have a beneficial impact. I would not like to see newspapers go away, and I don't think that that question is influenced too much by the fact that we're going more toward corporate-owned newspapers. For the most part, corporations do not try to influence the policies of their own editorial pages. There are examples where they do, and sometimes they do on major things like presidential endorsements, but generally they let their newspaper kind of analyze issues and endorse or take a position in editorials. So.
We can obviously agree that exit polls are flawed, but what about polls in general? Are they news? Aren't polls usually commissioned by major news organizations, a clear way in which the media influence the electorate?
I agree, basically, with the criticism that's implied in that question. A lot of the polls that are conducted are commissioned by news organizations, newspaper, TV networks, or sometimes in combination. And they commission these polls and get the results, and then they write stories about the polls that they commission. I think there's way too much emphasis on polls. I think it does sometimes have a bad impact on outcomes. If you're the kind of person who likes to go with a winner and you see that so-and-so is leading in the polls and probably going to win, it may influence you to go cast your vote for that person. If you're a contrarian, it may induce you to go cast your vote the other way, I suppose. But I think there is way too much reliance on polls, especially with regard to elections. That's not to say that I think the polls are usually wrong. I think they're usually right, but I think they're usually right at the moment they're done and limited to the exact question that they ask. And sometimes things change between the time the poll is taken and a day later or when the election occurs, and often it does depend on the way the question's phrased as to what kind of answer you get. I would like to see newspapers rely much less on polls, use them more kind of for their own guidance, or if they're going to do stories on them, play them more inside the paper, not give them such huge prominence.
Do you believe that there is adequate protection to individuals from false and or slanderous news stories, for example, the National Enquirer?
Well, that's a tough question. We do have libel laws that are supposed to protect people against damage to their character or reputation, false damage or reputation to their character in news publications. Sometimes it works well. Sometimes it doesn't. I actually think there's probably too many libel suits brought rather than too few, but I know sometimes people feel mistreated by news organizations, and the news organization is often that big organization that's tough and expensive to take on. Newspapers ethically need to obviously not try to legally libel anybody, but they also should be more careful than they sometimes are about invading the privacy of people who are not in the public eye. But the laws of libel are very complicated. They vary depending on whether the person who's written about is a public official, somebody in the public eye who has put themselves into the public eye, or whether there's somebody like you just sitting here being an individual, not asking to be written about or destroyed some way in a news publication. I think there are laws there that are adequate in letter, but sometimes difficult for people to actually employ and use given the power of the news organizations themselves.
How well have the media covered the strangeness of the Electoral College? What, in your view, are the consequences if Bush wins the Electoral College and the presidency and Gore wins the popular vote?
Right. It's funny how that question is switched, you know. I mean, on the Bush-Gore part of it, who was going to come up with the most popular votes and who was going to win the Electoral College. Well, you need to get a historian or political scientist up here to discuss this question. The Electoral College is very confusing to most people. There's reasons, of course, why it exists, partly to protect smaller states. It seems like kind of an anachronism in this day and age, but there may still be reasons to keep it. I'm not qualified to really say what I think should be done, but I think it's absolutely clear that there's going to be another look at it after this election, because this now appears to be the closest election in American history in vote margin, unless it changes more than it looks like it's going to. So there's going to be a lot of talk about what the Electoral College is, why did we have it, where did it come from, and should we get rid of it. I wouldn't want to try to predict the outcome of that, except to say that after every election, there's always complaints, often complaints about the Electoral College. There's complaints about polls. There's complaints about campaign financing rules. And everybody says, we have to change these things. And then the election's over, and people go back to what they were doing, and all of a sudden it's 4 years later, and here's another election. So whether or not this one is disrupting enough in some way that it's actually going to cause the kind of change that these concerns have not caused in the past, I just don't know.
I have a couple of locally oriented questions for you. The first is, the consolidation of the Chronicle and the Examiner staffs will allow the Chronicle to become competitive along the lines of the LA Times or Washington Post, according to Hearst. Do you believe that Hearst will devote the resources to do this?
The
consolidation of the two papers will allow the Chronicle to become competitive along the lines of the LA Times and the Washington Post.
Right. Well, what they're referring to there, I think, is the declaration when this sale took place that this was now a chance and the Hearst Company was dedicated to making the Chronicle a so-called world-class newspaper. I think that's where this came from, that they were going to enter the company of papers like the New York Times and so on in terms of quality. Sure, that could happen. I mean, I don't know. It all depends what Hearst wants to do, and we don't know what they want to do. We don't know who the publisher of the paper is going to be. We don't know, unless you accept what I said was on this website recently, which was that John Opadahl, the publisher of the Arizona Republic in Phoenix, is going to be the new publisher here. Some people say Phil Bronstein, the current editor of the Examiner, is going to be the new editor of the Chronicle. I don't know. But anyway, they haven't announced that yet. But it's a matter of, do they really want to devote the resources into turning this into the kind of paper it could be? The Chronicle, there's some good things about the San Francisco Chronicle. It's got some awfully good writers. It's quite logically edited. It's easy to read. I don't mean that negatively. I mean, it's easy to follow, to open up and know where things are going to be. But I don't think it's the newspaper San Francisco deserves. I think it could be better in a number of ways. And one of the first things they're going to have to do is fix the Sunday paper, which is one of the strangest Sunday newspapers in America, published by two different companies in two different typefaces, so that it doesn't even look like one newspaper, and then shuffled together. And I understand why that's true. It was part of the joint operating agreement that those two papers operated under. But they're going to have to fix that first. And then there's some other things that I feel that they need to do to the Chronicle, too. But it's all a matter of will and spending money. And if Hearst wants to do it, they've got the money to do it.
And speaking of joint operating agreements, I have a question relating to that. One method Congress has chosen to protect individual newspapers has been the joint operating agreements granted for some communities. How would you rate this initiative?
Well, I think it's kept some newspapers alive that probably wouldn't have been kept alive otherwise. I think it's been kind of a mixed success. Some of the cities that have been under joint operating agreements for a while, such as San Francisco, are ending those agreements. A number of other cities, the same thing has happened. There's some going the other direction. The Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News and Denver are about to go into a joint operating agreement as a way to try to keep the Rocky Mountain News from going under, because it's the smaller of the two newspapers and apparently losing money. I'd say it's had a mixed success. The theory behind it, of course, was that the large newspapers would become dominant in any city and tend to drive out the smaller newspaper, and then you only have one news editorial voice, and that it was better to have competing voices, and the only way you could do it was allow them to combine their business, circulation, advertising offices, which otherwise would be a violation of antitrust laws, but they allow them to do it under this law in hopes to preserve them. It's been a mixed success. It's helped for a while in some towns, not much in others.
With giant consolidations in communications industries, can a company like Knight Ridder survive if it remains almost entirely in the newspaper business?
If I knew, I'd probably be running a large media company if I knew the answer to that. I don't have a clue, except that I'll tell you that Knight Ridder for a while did start to get more into some other businesses. They owned a number of broadcast properties. They were getting a little bit into some high-tech and new media things. They funded a research project designed to try to invent a so-called flat newspaper, an electronic newspaper that you could carry around with you like a tablet, and the different pages would come up on it as you pressed buttons or touched it or something. They basically have given up on those things. Not that they don't think necessarily that they'll work, but that they decided their core interests were newspapers. That's what they knew how to run the best, and they've pulled back pretty much to running newspapers. I would not presume to advise them if that's the right step or not.
We have a question about the Knight Fellowships, what they're all about, and how persons are selected for the program, both domestically and from overseas.
Lee's referring to the program that I ran at Stanford for 15 years called the Knight Fellowships. The idea of it is to find outstanding journalists at sort of mid-career, give them a year off from work, let them come study at a great university like Stanford for a year, study things that will make them more knowledgeable at whatever it is they do in journalism, whatever their specialty is, and then go back to work and become even better journalists, we would hope. It's open to both print and broadcast and online journalists. 12 journalists each year from the United States, 8 from foreign countries. Some of them have been speakers here at this club various times. I participated in the program myself as a fellow long before I ever ran the program. It had a big impact on my career in terms of what I learned, what I knew, how I performed better as a journalist afterwards, so I'm a great booster of these kinds of programs that give people a little time away from deadlines, chance to learn. How you measure success, hard to know, although former Knight Fellows at Stanford have won a total of 23 Pulitzer Prizes, which I think is an awfully good record, and many other kinds of journalistic awards.
If you were approached by a young student today about a career in journalism, in what direction would you point this student?
By the way, on the last part of the question, you asked how people get selected for Knight Fellowships. It's an application process. You have to apply, write some essays, provide work samples, and so on, and then there's a committee that sifts these and chooses the winners. It's very competitive, about 10 to 1 are the number of applicants to number of people that win. Young journalists, the traditional advice always was, either get a journalism degree or get a liberal arts undergraduate degree and work on the school newspaper while you're doing it, so that you've got a little bit of background. And the traditional starting place to work has always been small to medium-sized newspapers, on the very practical argument that that's where you're more likely to be able to get a job, but also it's a place where you get to do lots of different things, fairly small staff, and you get lots of different kinds of experience in reporting, editing, and editing, and then can move on. I still think that ideally that's the best way into the business, whether you're going to end up eventually or hope to end up at a big newspaper or in the online world or in broadcast, because you learn skills in newspaper journalism about writing and editing and organizing material that is usable in both broadcast and online journalism, and you're not as likely to learn it there if you try to start there. By there, I mean broadcast or online places, as you would if you started a newspaper. So I still think that's the best place to start. More and more, though, you do see young people going into journalism and directly out of school into broadcast or into online. Some of them flourish and do very well.
This will be our last question, and it's a consolidation of several I've received, asking your opinion on what you think, which are the best newspapers at the national and local levels.
Okay. That's one of these things where everybody can make their own list, right, if you're a newspaper reader. The New York Times is the best newspaper in the United States. I'll state that as a flat statement. Other very good newspapers that would be considered sort of national are the Wall Street Journal, which, of course, is a certain and unusual kind of paper, with still an emphasis on business and finance, although now containing many other things. I used to think USA Today was a horrible newspaper. I now think it's pretty good, and I don't mind reading it when I'm traveling especially. I think it's pretty good, actually. Some people consider the Los Angeles Times a form of national newspaper. Whether you do or whether you don't, I think it's an excellent and high-quality newspaper. Smaller local level or cities with very good newspapers, I don't know what comes to mind. St. Petersburg Times, St. Petersburg, Florida, probably the largest independently owned newspaper in the United States and probably the best of the independent papers and certainly in the top 10 quality of American newspapers. Philadelphia Inquirer, perhaps. Some people would put the Boston Globe in that ranking. Some people wouldn't. Chicago Tribune, very good newspaper these days. What else comes to mind? Anybody want to shout one out? Oh, sorry, Washington Post, of course. Yes. It's right up there, number two or three or something like that. Sorry, I don't know how that slipped my mind. There's others. Baltimore Sun has become a particularly good newspaper again in recent years. It's gone through ups and downs. It's quite a good newspaper these days. I would highly recommend the Jackson, Tennessee Sun because my son is the managing editor there.
Thank you, James Risser, Professor Emeritus of Journalism at Stanford University, for your remarks here today. And we also thank our audience here in San Francisco, as well as those listening on radio, and invite you to join us again soon. Now, this meeting of the Stanford San Francisco Club and the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.